So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm reviews editor Sherlyn Lowe.
I'm senior editor Devendra Hardawar.
And this week we had a heck of a lot of hardware news. In addition to all the usual news that's going on, we had Samsung had an awesome Unpacked event that's in quotes. Google announced a new smart display. Intel and AMD have a bunch of chip news that Devendra worked really hard to cover for us. So we'll be digging into all of that in addition to some other news updates from all around the world of tech. And also to help unpack some of Samsung's news, we also have special guest senior mobile editor Chris Velasco here with us. We'll get to that in a little bit. But as always, if you're enjoying the show, please make sure to subscribe to us on your podcast catcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes so that people know we're kind of okay. And if you want to interact with us live during the recording of this podcast, we're on the Engadget YouTube channel every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern. So head on over there. Come talk to us. Also, as a bonus this week, we have some special interviews at the end of this episode. So make sure you listen all the way. It's kind of like a post-credits bonus. Mine, I have an interview with Robert Kirkman, known best as for his work on The Walking Dead.
But I mean, creating he also has The Walking Dead, right?
Creating yeah. The Walking yeah. Dead, the comic series, in addition to the show on AMC. But he is back with another animated series. This is coming to Amazon. It's called Invincible. I talked to him a little bit about it, what it's like working with Amazon, what it's like adapting his animation for an animated series. So do stay tuned and check it out. Dev, what have you got for us?
Yeah, I talked with Fede Alvarez, a director I really like, and he's behind the new TV series on Apple TV called Calls. And this show, we wrote it up. You could go check out the trailer. But it's really an audio drama with very limited visuals. Like, it is a series of phone calls, and on the screen you can see, you know, bits of dialogue and things like that and visual imagery, but it's really about the audio experience. So I talked with him about what it was like creating this thing that's kind of just a podcast, but you're watching on your TV too. That was a fun chat. So yeah, stay tuned for that.
All right, everyone. So Samsung had its third virtual event this year, and it's only March. But yesterday, Wednesday, the 17th of March, Samsung had a awesome Unpacked event. That name is the company's, not mine.
I feel like they're really trying to sell it too hard because it's like, it's not even the flagship phone. So it's like, we've got some meh phones. Let's call it awesome. You know, everything is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to say that if you start labeling something with a word that means it's really, really good, you're setting yourself up for disappointment.
It's Samsung, yeah.
Yeah, it is Samsung. So the Galaxy Awesome Unpacked event was to for it to unveil the A series, or its slightly more affordable line of smartphones. And here to break that all down with us is Chris Velasco, Engadget's senior mobile editor. Hey, V, how are you?
Hey, fam. What's up, squad? Let's eat this show into the stratosphere.
God. Now the reason
did I get that right?
Are you okay? Are you having an aneurysm, V? Are you all right?
I just had a stroke. Also, was any of that correct? Did I use any of those words correctly?
You had a case of the youngs. Let's put it there.
And so as did Samsung, apparently.
As did Samsung. Basically, for those who didn't tune in to Samsung's event or haven't caught up yet, Samsung's event was just cringeworthy the whole entire time, because Samsung was like, yeah, this event is for everyone. That's kind of like what its invitation said. It was like, oh, Galaxy for everyone. But apparently, according to Samsung's dictionary, everyone means people maybe under the age of 21. Sure. And uses lingo that includes a heavy repetition of the word squad, awesome, besties, iconic, clutch, They did not say yeet. I will say they did not say yeet, but it definitely brings to mind that. V, did you feel old watching the Sans on
So that's a loaded question because I constantly feel old anyway. But this really did feel like one of the first times where I officially have like transitioned out of like the target market of a company, right?
Aww.
Like, and I can live with that. There's no shame in that. I've learned a lot along the way. But yeah, I think you raised a really interesting point, right? Like the A series, which stretches from devices like the A01, which is like a $100 phone, all the way up to new devices like the A72 for the equivalent of around $500 to $600. They only announced European pricing. This is a smartphone line with such huge reach. So for them to focus on what feels for now like a very, very small slice of the market, especially a market from what we understand that generally seems to gravitate towards high-end devices, whether they're new or not, felt a bit puzzling.
Yeah. I want to just go back to the beginning of Samsung's event, where the first thing I think we were treated to is something called the Awesome Song, and it's a remix of Samsung's All Over the Horizon ringtone. we have a clip prepared for you, dear listener and viewer. Those on the YouTube stream will get to see me and V's live reaction to it. Let's see if we have that ready for you guys. But this song.
You have plenty of content to send to your squad or to wow your followers. We're talking hard-eye reactions to your stories, subscribers to your channel, maybe even a DM from your crush.
I just saw our band.
And a Peloton. This is...
Squad, stay tuned for the post show.
Squad, stay tuned for the post show, squad.
And yeah, that was my instant reaction to this remix. It sounds a bit Beat Saber-esque. I don't know what you think about that, Dev.
Yeah, sure, kind of. It sounds like somebody who had like a mixer in front of them and just like kept hitting that beat quite a lot. So No words.
That should have been our first clue as to what the rest of the event would have been like. But I just was like, oh, okay. All right, we got a beat. And then
It sounds kind of like if somebody was tasked with, you know, making that remix and their toddler walked in and just like hit the keyboards like, awesome. It's exactly the kind of music Sophia makes right now, my daughter.
Totally. I mean, I would love to hear her tracks. But besides the music, and we'll get into I want to tell you all what, you know, the intro to was with this event, but V, did you have any thoughts once you heard this song what the event was going to be like?
I mean, it's always a tricky situation because everyone is always pretty aware of what an event is going like going into one of these things, but this was kind of a completely different story. I have to say it, like, I didn't expect Samsung to lean so heavily into the young sort of vernacular. I didn't expect them to try and just like relate to people under 25 as strongly as they did, which again is cool. We've thrown around the word cringe a bunch already, and I think it definitely was that. But on the flip side, and I really like hate myself for seemingly coming to Samsung's defense, but here's the thing. If they didn't use that cringe ass song, or if they didn't like try to communicate with the viewers the way they did the other day, we wouldn't be talking about this event. Like, there's a reason it stuck with us this whole time.
Yeah, because these are not normally phones we devote much time to, right? The A series have been around for a while. They've been budget phones and kind of cool, but I see why they're doing this. It makes sense because teenagers probably would want cheap phones too. Their parents may not want to get them the Galaxy S whatever now, right? If they can get a really nice 3-camera phone for under $500, right?
And
Let's put it this way, okay? So this is Charles Hsieh, the guy who opened the event, and this is, I guess, Samsung's point of view as to like why they're pandering to this segment. Charles Hsieh opened saying, the Galaxy A series, we want to put the technology we need at every person's fingertips. Galaxy A, it's no surprise that its biggest fans belong to the next generation of influencers. This is a generation that's harnessed the power of we as in W-E, not Nintendo's W-I-I, witness the global cultural sync and come together with friends from around the world to stan icons, organize their own issues, and everything in between. He said Stan icons. Oh, I can't imagine God. He said stand icons.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, that, I don't want to sound too shocked intro. Here. There was also a report, by the way, like, I forget if you guys noticed this, but Samsung announced that they're having chip shortages. There may not be a new Note this year. So I also wonder if they're starting to, like, say, like, hey, we got to really push more into the lines we already have rather than debut way too many phones that too many people that, you know, not enough people can buy.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, we knew kind of going into this year that the Note was probably not going to happen anyway. And in the report that you mentioned, which I believe was first published by Bloomberg the night before the event, DJ Ko said, you know, hey, we were probably looking at streamlining our smartphones anyway. But because the A72, the A52, the A52 5G were already in the works, they've probably already allotted, as you say, for just like all of the chips, all of the components needed, because everyone is struggling really hard right now.
And you know, they listen to the Engadget podcast. We've talked about Samsung having too many phones. It's exactly what we've been saying over the last year or so. Samsung, listen, that's all.
Yeah, it feels to me like we have to rethink the way we expect certain things out of different parts of the Samsung smartphone population. I'll get to that a little bit later. I want to do this, like, just the very last thing I'll have to say on Samsung appealing to the youngs, and then we can talk about the phones. But I think some of the – so this – use of young vernacular happened all around, all throughout. It wasn't just in the intro. Specifically, I think when they were talking about the camera, it was very heavy. But there's a point of contention here for me. And I would love your thoughts on it, V and Devendra, but also our audience. So in addition to using words like squad, which, by the way, they use at least four times, if not five or six times, which caused us, our video team.
Yeah,
we had a squad counter that they came up with last minute because we didn't think Samsung was going to say the word squat so many times, but we're going to do a live counter anyway. So they said squat so many times. They said the camera was iconic and your pictures will be clutch quality. And you'll get hearts from all your followers. There's like a whole movement to it. But at some point during that that segment too, the person saying all those words about the camera also said that this camera would be great for vlogging. We have a clip of this.
He said vlogging?
Right, yeah, listen.
Let's say you're vlogging with a friend on a typical camera, filming while you're...
What is vlogging? That's not even an old person.
That was a younger person in the Samsung event.
People say that sometimes, though. Like,
really?
I've heard people
this
say
is
it.
Not
maybe
a
maybe
GIF,
not
GIF
like...
discussion.
So,
you know?
our dear listener and viewer, let us know, what is the answer, the hard definition of how to pronounce that word? Is it vlog or is it vlog?
We know it's vlog.
But
tell us if you have feels about it. But anyway, that's the last thing I'll say. It's not like they're very in touch.
Yeah,
it's a bit contentious.
This whole event seems like they're doing the "How do you do, fellow kids?" meme.
Oh,
you know?
That came
like
up a lot.
The entire thing. So
our life
is hilarious, but also
on fire.
Yeah, as we're discussing, probably makes a lot of business sense for them, even if they're not communicating properly to the kids.
Yeah, but anyway, like I said, that would be the last I complained about the whole like young person vernacular for at least this show anyway. V, though, can you tell us a little bit about these new phones?
So yeah, we've got... Samsung has sort of an interesting lineup here. And before we get into the devices themselves, I feel like we really just need to stress the fact that the A series is like a huge business for Samsung.
Yeah.
If you look at least one research firm, Omdia, at the end of last year, sort of went through and just sort of ranked smartphone sales by sales volume. Like the A51 was up there, the Galaxy A01, the A21S, like these are all heavy hitters and they contribute significantly to Samsung's bottom line. So I do think it's kind of nice they finally decided, hey, let's give the meat and potatoes of our smartphone line a proper presentation. Mm-hmm. But sort of an interesting pack this year. That's mostly because the A52 and the A72 are very, very similar devices. They have very similar screen sizes. One uses a 6.5-inch Super AMOLED screen. The other uses a 6.7. The A72 has a larger battery, obviously, because it's a slightly bigger phone. But beyond that, they use the same Snapdragon 720G. There are some differences in the cameras. All three devices use a 64-megapixel main camera with optical image stabilization and I believe an f1.8 aperture. That's really tying heavily into Samsung's approach of giving people solid cameras at all price points.
This would be a flagship phone like 2 years ago. Like,
for
this
sure,
is
for sure.
Great.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing that's easy to kind of overlook when you mm-hmm. get stuck in the trappings of like the event itself. Like, these are legitimately good phones. The the A52 5G in itself is particularly interesting to play nice with a sort of sub-6 5G networks you'll find more of around the world than millimeter wave. It uses a Qualcomm Snapdragon 750G chipset, which is a little bit newer, actually a little bit faster than the processors you'll find in the other two A-series devices that were announced the other day. You do get a slightly faster screen too. So all of these phones have high refresh rate displays.
Wow.
The A52 mm-hmm. and the A72 have 90 hertz screens, but the A52 5G has the full on 120 hertz, same refresh rate you get out of Samsung's flagship. So for the equivalent of like $400 to $600, depending on the exact device, you're getting a really competitive spec sheet.
Apple has no excuse at this point, by the way, to keep high refresh rate screens out of the iPhone. Like, that has to happen this
year. Oh, yeah. This is $350 euro, anyway, phone, and it has a 90 hertz screen to start with. I will say, though, the branding remains confusing to me, right? Like, I would think of the A72 as a high-end one, but it sounds like the A52 5G is the more premium within this lineup. Is that correct, V?
I mean, that's certainly one way of looking at it, and that's how I've just sort of naturally looked at it. Like, every company sort of has their own weird naming scheme, and Samsung's has been generally pretty straightforward. Like, the higher the number, the better it is. But 5G has kind of thrown a wrench into the mix because, you know, a 5G device, even though it sort of belongs to a theoretically lesser tier within that model structure, like, just because a lot of developing markets don't have 5G and don't have to worry about it, these things will generally be sold in, like, Korea, Europe, probably. We might get one of these things in the US. So in those markets where the situation tends to be a bit more developed, it's not a huge surprise to see them investing in a few more premium features. But it does kind of feel a bit lopsided here.
One of the things that surprised me was that they also named Space Zoom as one of the features on this. You get, 30 times on these devices with up to 3 times optical zoom, I believe. And with the S series having had that as their kind of the standout feature for the last, I don't know, 2 years now, for it to trickle down, I guess, that quickly to the A series is just fascinating for me because, like, wow, there's almost no reason for most people who are on some sort of budget to pay for that S series now, especially with the going away we're hearing of the Note series. It seems like the S series is quickly taking over as the phone for the specs obsessed, right? Like, S series may soon take over the Note series spiritually, especially if S Pen support. Yeah. Well, S Pen support's already here for the S series, and then the Notes, the Folds maybe will have them. Are we supposed to think of the A series as an upcoming successor to the S series and the S as the new Notes?
I'm surprised they didn't just change the name. Like, this should be called the Galaxy Squad, to be honest. Like, the Galaxy Squad lineup. Galaxy Squad 5G. Yeet, yeet, yeet.
we need a Devendra Speaks the Youngs counter.
Sorry.
He said squad and yeet. We did this, people. We did it. Woo! What else? What else can we get Devendra to say? Let's see. But the Galaxy Squad, S being the first letter, so maybe the next is the Q series, and then there's a U series for the underperformers. I don't know.
They gotta, like, all these companies just gotta change up their names. Like, we don't have to stick with the A series. Nobody cares. Nobody cares if you if it's Galaxy Squad 1, Galaxy Squad 2, or something. Like, anyway, they could totally do that. But I think we're really getting at the heart of this, right? Like, I like cheap phones. And I like good tech getting to cheaper phones, and that's really the key here, I think, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's no contesting the fact that all companies are now paying way more attention to the mid-range line than they used to. Apple, good. I mean, I hate to, like, drag Apple into this, but they released the iPhone SE around this time last year, and it gave you, like, an A13 and pretty solid performance out of a device that looks like it's 4 or 5 years old. So, like, that's maybe not great.
But they also had to kill the 12 mini, right? Or basically wind that down because people didn't really want the slightly smaller premium phone, too.
Yeah.
Like, people want the budget phone, but not the cheaper, smaller,
the cute
premium.
Little baby.
A lot of things to learn here.
Yeah, I do feel bad for all the people who've been, like, clamoring for a premium small phone because, like, it's such a vocal minority. People really care about this stuff, and it felt like they got what they wanted, and
it's a Twilight Zone episode. Like, you got what you wanted, but what you wanted has less battery life, and that is the the consequence of your wishes.
Careful what you wish for.
Yeah, exactly.
An entire slice of the industry is like stuck in a library at the end of the world, but their glass is broken.
It's too small.
But I like the idea that the mid-range or the more affordable lineup is getting a bit more attention, and it looks like soon we might be, you know, giving the high-end flagships that are $1,000 phones at this point, you know, giving them the space of the notes, the even more high-end. Sure. I think if we start thinking of them as like more luxury and maybe normalize, I guess, the ownership of a mid-range phone, maybe it'll give these companies a bit more pressure to bring these better features down faster.
We started going crazy. Yeah, I know. But go ahead. Yeah.
Do you think that's what where we're headed? Like where we're going to start treating the $500 range as the mainstream range?
I mean, look, I certainly hope that's where we wind up. We're all fans of cheap, good phones, and I think we all agree that more people should be buying them. But there's a level of like cultural weight and cachet that comes with having a phone that everyone knows is $1,000, and that's not something that Samsung or Apple or whatever is going to be able to sort of beat out of us by changing their branding around. It's just a nature of consumerism, and we all have to spend a lot of time just sort of steeped in it, and it's not great. Like, I do firmly believe that most people would be better off buying like a $600 phone, saving the $400 and just sort of like having a little bit of buffer in their lives. But these companies have a vested interest in selling us the biggest, most, you know, profit margin laden devices possible. And those are the ones that cost $1,000 plus.
Yeah. It's all Apple's fault, by the way. Like, Apple is the genius at pushing prices higher, and they pushed past $1,000. And we were all like, this is not great. And Samsung was like, oh, $1,000. Try a $2,400 phone. Things went crazy. But I do hope we kind of normalize, because, hey, we're not walking around showing everybody our phones, right? The cultural cachet of walking around saying, I have the iPhone 12 Pro doesn't exist unless you're creating content for, you know, TikTok or something, right? So, yeah.
Which is the generation that the Samsung's awesome Unpacked event was targeting, but for some reason they're like, here's this €350 phone that we think is going to be good for the yeets or something. And I don't even know how to use that
word. We gotta just create our own words. I bet we can make something happen.
Yeet your vegetables, that's what I'm gonna
say.
Eat
your vegetables.
People do eat their vegetables.
Oh no. I hope I didn't, that wasn't obscene. Anyway. I've been using the Pixel 4a for almost a year now. It's a $350 phone. It doesn't have the fastest processor. It doesn't have these quad camera setups, but it's gotten the job done. Again, caveat being it's been a pandemic year. I've not been going out a lot, so battery life is dramatically less important to me. But still, like, it turns out I can live with a $350 phone. Maybe we all can. But
maybe we all can.
It's philosophically
really something to think about. Yeah.
Something to chew on, y'all. Something to yeet on. Oh, I can't.
Yeet on that.
Oh, yeet on that. Okay. Let's move on from yeet to there was a point in Samsung's event where they used the word accessible, and just based on what I've been covering for the last few months or so, that got my attention. And I was like, "Oh, do they have some new cool features?" But Samsung was referring to accessibility in terms of price. These phones, the good thing about them is that like they're offering a very compelling set of features at a more affordable, therefore more accessible price, which I'm interested in. But I would like to point out, and V, I don't know if you realized this maybe after the fact, but there was no ASL interpreter this time. Whereas for the last two keynotes that Samsung had, they had an ASL interpreter. And that was, like, noted on Twitter, at least I saw. But this time around, none.
Yeah, and I did notice that.
Yeah. Do they think maybe younger people don't need a sign language interpreter?
I think it's fair to say a lot of what happened yesterday was not fully thought through. Yeah. So it's maybe not a surprise that they left
They
that
used
part.
Their entire budget on the Young Speak. You know, you got to license yeet. You got to, like...
That song cost so much money, by the way.
Oh, no. They paid so much for the awesome, awesome remix song that they could not afford an ASL. Awesome sign language interpreter.
Speaking of, like, the market they're aiming for with this, I really wonder, why was this a big, like, live streamed event. You mm-hmm. know, like it seems like if you're trying to go after this market, maybe go after where they are. So I guess, yeah, we're talking about it because it's a big thing. We had to devote time to it. But I can also imagine like Samsung feeding TikTok with some really creative videos showing off these new cameras and what they do and letting that kind of spread and, you know, kind of having shorter bits, not like a big professional event, but having shorter ways to convey what these phones are and what they're doing. I don't know. It seems like there are ways to rethink this, but these companies, they're not thinking creatively, right? They're just... they want to copy what's trending now, and that is Yeet and YoungSpeak, I guess.
A few of these clips did wind up on Samsung's TikTok after the event. So, like, maybe they designed this around having some sort of more social forward content to be able to pull from. But, yeah, no, I totally agree with you. In general, it was not amazing.
To repeat a word that I overuse, I want to shout out our live chat viewers or live chat participants from yesterday's live stream, where Daniel Cocaine and Mark Dell, are some of our regular viewers, envisioned the planning meeting that might have happened that led to yesterday's event, which is potentially people at Samsung HQ had a take your kids to work day, and they're like, you know, this phone is cool vibes, fam. Let's vibe check this a sec. And then they were just like, yeah, that's a great idea. We need to follow what the young people say. And then I think someone else in the chat yesterday, Maori QHD, I believe is their username, said, imagine the popcorn eating party right now going over at Apple Park. What do you think Apple is going to come back with?
Apple does not. Like, I bet you nobody at Apple had any idea this event was happening. They didn't care. Like, it is so beneath Apple. Maybe somebody, like, was like, they saw on Twitter while they were in the bathroom, huh, Samsung has new stuff. That's cool. Back to, you know, our AR glasses and our Apple car and all the cool stuff that's going to change the world.
And for some reason, the target audience for Samsung's event, they just use Apple anyway, no matter how hard. Maybe that's why they had to target that anyway. But V, you're our Apple person, at least on the mobile beat. What do you think Apple like feels about this, or is like anyway?
At least going off of the conversations I tend to have with them about this stuff, like the official party line would be something like, we don't give a damn. And I'm sure that's true to some extent, but Apple is, in fairness, one of those companies you just see kind of seemingly throwing their weight around for no reason. Like, if maybe fine, no one knew that Unpacked was happening and no one or Apple was paying attention. There have been instances in the past, like not too long ago, they scheduled their event for like the same day as a OnePlus event.
Yep.
And I refuse to believe that like no one looked up anything about that day.
Yep.
And the obvious conclusion is they just decided, hey, you know what? Screw those guys. Like, let's just do it. Let's just do our thing. So I do believe that Apple sort of looks at the industry and sort of gets a feel for where it's going, but it does sometimes treat everyone else with like total contempt.
Speaking of OnePlus, they have an event coming up and we're expecting another phone from them. But to be clear, OnePlus made its mark for doing exactly what Samsung is trying to do now, which is squeeze a lot of good features for a fraction of flagship prices. Do you think, I know they've uptrended a little bit in terms of price lately, but do we think OnePlus's next phone is going to be better than the A50 or 72? And can we maybe, should we be holding out for a OnePlus instead of buying an A something?
It's tough to say. Yeah. So going into this event, I'm fairly sure what we're looking at are two sort of high-end devices. So something like the OnePlus 9 Pro and then the slightly down-market OnePlus 9. And there might be some overlap between a OnePlus 9, the sort of dialed-down version of that true flagship device that now carries the true flagship price. There might be some overlap between that and something like the A72. But I expect that to be pretty minimal. If anything, it seems like the OnePlus Nord line is kind of where OnePlus is really gunning for the kind of market that the A series has been going after. So no, if you're like looking for a cheap phone, you probably don't need to wait for OnePlus to announce whatever it has to get a feel for what's going on. But on the flip side, yes, also everyone should wait and buy a new phone as late as humanly possible because of deals, because of launch windows, because of launch windows affecting other companies and them introducing deals. Like, it's a weird interconnected economic ecosystem that we're sort of watching unfold every time something comes out. So the best advice, as always, is to just hang in there for as long as you can.
We'll have to wait and see what OnePlus announces. That'll be next week on Tuesday. For those of you who are so inclined and like to check out YouTube, come back on the 23rd, I believe at 9:40 a.m. Eastern, where V and I will once again be watching it live with you. Bring your popcorn, bring your yeets, and your squad. We're going to talk now about another piece of hardware that was introduced this week. And this, to me, was super fascinating when I first heard about it. This is Google's Nest Hub second generation. And it's a smart display, you know, pretty par for the course. Except it can track your sleep by
using... It's a bit of a pervert, this smart
by using radar. So the idea is you set up this 7-inch display somewhere near your bed, within a couple feet of your bed. You angle it to face where you're sleeping, and you calibrate it. You do a setup process, and you lay in the middle of where you would usually sleep. You know, if you tend to roll around, just kind of like lay in the middle of where you tend to roll around. And the thing will use radar to detect motion, so your movements in bed, to see if you're asleep or not, and then track it and do the things that a sleep tracker would do. So, you know, how long have you been asleep? How much were you restless? It also has other sensors on board, like a third microphone as opposed to just two in the generation before, and temperature sensor, ambient light sensor. It uses all these things to detect things like whether you've coughed, you snored, how cold it was in your room, how bright it was in your bedroom, and then tell you the next day, like, hey, you were restless these times, and this was the temperature, light amount, and sounds in the environment. Yeah, it uses the Soli radar chip that showed up in the Pixel 4. It's also in the Nest thermostat, the newest Nest thermostat. So it's not a camera. It's not like watching you sleep. So for those who are concerned about privacy in the bedroom, there's not a camera here.
This promo video does not look great, to be honest. It is like this little thing just buzzing rays out of your nightstand and staring at you. This is, it's not a camera, but it does feel a little creepy as hell. I'd say, like, where can also they take this? Like, I can imagine your bedroom activities after a certain point, Google's going to start giving you ratings and judgments on that too. Like, stay out of my bedroom, Google, please.
That was my first question for this, right? And that was a fun conversation to have with Google, by the way, where I could not say the word sex or...
Uh-huh. I mean, you could. We're adults. Yeah.
I could. But I was trying to be professional, y'all. And I was trying to be like, how about other activities in the bed? Other movements in the bed? Like jumping about. Some people wrestle in their bed, you know? But yeah, so basically what the sensor or the smart display is getting is what looks like it's a spectrograph, and it looks, it's lines that jump up and down, and it looks more like an ECG that's very active or something. I don't even really know how to describe it better than that. But so it's not seeing images. And what the algorithm does is when it's looking at this spectrograph, it applies that algorithm to be like, okay, this pattern of activity is flipping around and tossing and turning in bed. Whereas this activity that looks a little more rigorous could be something else. And we're just going to ignore that.
Are you going to trust Google to ignore that?
Well, that's what the algorithm is supposed to do. I don't know. We can get into like whether or not we trust Google. But the other thing, speaking about trust, by the way, so this information where it's interpreted into sleep data, that is processed on device. It doesn't get sent anywhere for processing. It's only after your data has been identified as sleep, restlessness, coughing, etc. And that's what's finally then parsed or passed on to Google Fit, the app with which you can look at your data on your smartphone. So,
but that still goes to a cloud before it gets to the app, right? Like there's still a cloud hit, or does it go straight from the device to your phone or something?
The cloud hit, but what the cloud gets though is like, for example, it detects that you've been coughing or snoring, right?
Sure.
What the cloud gets is the fact that you've been coughing and snoring, and not the sounds of you coughing and snoring.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
Not the raw data, but the interpreted data. Mm. So slightly better, you know, no raw data, no sounds of whatever sounds you make at night.
It is kind of interesting because we've seen a lot of sleep tech, and I don't think anybody's used radar in this way before. And I've tried a lot of cool things. Like, I remember the Jawbone Up band, my beloved Jawbone Up, did a really good job of sleep tracking. You know, we've had sleep tracking wrist devices for so long. There are a lot of things that can fit into your bed to kind of help track your sleep. But this seems like the most inobtrusive way of doing that. It's just the idea of a little Google radar pinging me while I sleep just feels... That is kind of dystopian in many ways. But hey, maybe this will work out and be good.
I have thoughts on this, but V, what are your thoughts on this?
I am full of questions. And the one I guess I want to throw out there first is, how effective do you think this is? Like, how close does it have to be? Obviously, in this like little animation, the person it's tracking is like wearing covers. Like, do we expect that to be an issue, especially in winter when you're just kind of bundled up? Like, what's your sense of how well this could actually work?
I don't know. I don't think that they, I haven't tested it out and I will be testing it out. So I'll report back when I do, but I have the same skepticism you do, right? Heavy covers. The product manager during my briefing said that, the system is sensitive enough to detect micrometer movement of your chest for detecting your breathing. And, it has to be within a couple feet and angle towards you. So I think calibration is going to be part of whether or not you get an accurate reading. I will say this, I have been super frustrated with some of my Google smart home devices recently. My Chromecast just keeps dropping in and out of Wi-Fi. My Nest Audio just keeps dropping in and out. It pisses me the F off.
Imagine that.
So I don't know. I got so mad. So I don't know how well this is going to work. I will say though, like, to Devendra's point, I love the fact that they've done this because A, it's just very unique application of technology. They've just had... They are figuring out what to do with Soli. They're like, Soli is ready now for the mainstream, but we don't really know how to use Soli. Well, didn't work.
It's useful. I have the Google Nest with Soli, and like when I walk by, the thing will like pop up and tell me the time or something. Or if I walk by, it'll like kick up the heat because nobody's been moving in that room for a while. So it's been good for things like that more so than phones, I'd say. Yeah.
Totally.
I mean, it was never great on like when Google first started developing Soli, like their big push was exactly what they seem to be talking about now. Those very sort of like micro level gestures. Mm. One of their earliest demos was like you could like use your fingers to like control volume at a very granular level. And that sounded great. And it sounds like we're finally maybe getting a use for that very fine grained ability to monitor motion. But I don't know. I feel like if anyone has experience with Soli, it's probably due to something like using a Pixel 4, which did not do very well. And that's what really concerns me. Like, the Soli array in the Pixel 4 was meant for like very big, noticeable gestures. You were using your hand, you were swiping left and right to change tracks. And even then, it wasn't particularly good at it. So if you're telling me that Google has built up a thing that's supposed to sit a couple feet away from you that can tell the difference between your rise and fall of your chest and like your
and the
electric
rise and fall of other things.
Or the rise and fall of other things. Or like the
animals
electric
in your
fan
bed.
Moving your
everybody,
shirt around. Like
yeah,
so
everybody
many
sleeps
things.
With pets. Like, that's the other thing, too. Like, I have cats always crawling over me all night. You know, cats and dogs. Oh, my.
Oh, I'm kind of jealous.
That's one of the things that they even brought up themselves, where they know that, like, you know, your pet can jump in your bed in the middle of the night. And that sort of detection is – they performed 110,000 nights of tests and on about 10,000 individuals to see how accurate their system was. And they said that compared to the gold standard, which is polysomnographic studies, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. They said that was the gold standard, and they said there was no statistical difference between their results and those. And then compared to the sleep trackers already out there, whether it's wrist-worn, a wearable, or a metro sensor, they found that theirs were either comparable or at times even better. And again, we'll have to see this for ourselves. I think there's a difference between a controlled study and out in the real world. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that the algorithm has been trained to be smart enough to distinguish between when your cat is crawling across your bed, across your bed, versus when you're just flipping around or like reaching for your phone. And if you're reaching for your phone, the algorithm should be like, you're awake. What are you doing up, bro? Turn off Twitter, go to bed. You know, like, well, it won't say that, but you know what I mean.
I think there's something to be said about like the quality of that training too. So you said they tested this stuff for like 110,000
nights.
With how many people?
10,000 individuals.
I wonder how many of those 10,000 people had sex in front of this thing or just like abstained because they knew radar. Like and the training.
Badly, yeah.
Yeah.
You get what I'm doing.
They needed to not only have sex, let's be honest, they needed to exclude, right? This is stuff they had to find, identify, and then exclude. Mm-hmm. Which you are totally right. Did any engineer figure out what the algorithmic pattern of sex?
There's a lot of jumping up and down in this size in this graph.
Yeah.
This graph is just like going kids. up and down. I don't know what's up going on here.
This is a happy Thursday morning.
This is what happens when I come and crash the show.
Crash the show. Here's the other thing. If you also, if you like regularly sleep alone, but you know, occasionally you have a visitor stay over. Mm-hmm. I asked what would happen and would that affect your result? And the answer was that, well, maybe, but if it does, you can exclude that night. And the idea here on Google's end is that they don't want you to get hung up on one night of sleep data. They want you to focus on your general sleep patterns and do things that can help you sleep better. Yeah, sure. Things that are within your control, like
so what you're saying is there's going to be a one night stand button, basically, at some point.
I wish I was at this briefing.
I would just like add, Google has to answer the hard questions. Okay, so yeah,
I asked them in euphemistic ways. So don't worry. I had a lot of fun not only in this interview where I was struck coming up with different ways to say these things that I didn't want to be too explicit about for some reason, and also writing the posts, being like, how about when you have a stayover. Sure.
I don't know if this is going to go anywhere, this device. Sure.
I actually, you've given me an idea, V. I do need to test this thing out in a variety of situations. So we'll see how effective that stuff all is. So yeah, it's a very good question you pose. This is coming, y'all. I don't know. So you guys have... Well, okay. Look, in addition to the sleep sensing... Other stuff about the Nest Hub that's new from its predecessor. I mean, it's the same size screen. It's not just like a glorified digital photo album anymore, right? Because it can do sleep tracking. But now it's got a third microphone, like I said before. It's got an on-device machine learning chip, so assistants should be faster to respond to your queries. It's also got the new audio system that is now in the Nest Audio versus the kind of underwhelming system they had before. So better... Mm. Audio. The Nest Audio, honestly, for the size and the price, had really good audio quality. So that's really nice to have in this Nest Hub as well. So still some improvements here. Also, remember PChoip, Dev?
Yep.
From a few episodes ago, PChoip, as in...
I mean, last year, PChoip.
Yeah. Project Connected Home over IP, or what we decided to say, PChoip. There's support in the new Nest Hub... for Thread, which is what powers or enables the PChoip system that PChoip people are hoping will become a smart home platform that works in the future. So lots to learn about the new Nest Hub, and I can't wait to get it into test. Would love to hear all y'all's thoughts, so send them our way, podcast@engadget.com. Well, V, thank you so much for joining us for the conversation today. Where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter @ChrisVelasco, or you can just email me because I really like email. I'm V@Engadget.com.
Okay, now that we've kicked V out of here, let's talk about some real hardware, grown-up hardware, real muscle power in desktop PCs. Welcome to the PC Hardware Corner. This week... Intel announced its new 11th generation desktop CPUs, and these are the powerful ones. These are the ones that are going to be going into gaming desktops and things like that, and they're fine. They're interesting. Like I feel like there's not much more that we really need to say about Intel stuff these days, but the interesting thing is that the new top-end chip, the Core i9-1109, the 11900K, is an 8-core chip. that can reach up to 5.3 gigahertz. Last year's chip was actually 10 cores. So in a way, yeah, Intel is kind of moving backwards, but instead of packing in cores, it's ramping up clock speed. It's doing other things to speed up these chips. It's saying, you know, these chips are, I believe the figure was like up to 19% faster than last year's models in certain respects. So there are speed improvements. And I think the key here is that, you know, raw clock speed, you know, and performance within a single core or a couple cores is more important to games and gamers than having a ton of stuff out there, because most games do not take advantage of multi-core very well. So these chips look interesting, but I do think like the war now is between this and AMD's new Ryzen, you know, 5000 chips, and that war is continuing. But I also think, you know, we're starting to see the aging of Intel's architecture here. Intel, these are 14 nanometer chips. This is like a really aging process, whereas AMD is already at 7 and looking at like what they could do with 5 nanometers in a couple of years, you know. So Intel's just really lagging behind. But yeah, they've got new stuff at least. And yeah, it's good that Intel is, you know, showing off their new stuff. They also rolled out a new ad campaign for their laptops starring Justin Long, the I'm a Mac guy from the Apple commercials from 15 years ago. They're called Justin Gets Real, and it's basically him showing off different features that PCs have now, like 2-in-1 flexibility and gaming support and touchscreens, and just comparing them to Macs. And I see some people online and on Twitter who are really into these ads, because I think it's true. PCs genuinely have something over Macs these days, but the way they're going about this, getting Justin Long back, basically recreating Apple's old ad campaign, seems so desperate and kind of sad. Like, it just seems like Intel has been in defense mode ever since the M1 chip was announced. And as soon as we started seeing, you know, results from that, those chips are insanely fast. The M1 MacBook Air and MacBook Pro are some of the fastest machines I've ever tested. And Intel, rather than saying, okay, we got to, you know, buckle up and make our stuff a lot better, Intel's like, no, look at what Apple's can't do. You know, look at what Macs can't do. And it just feels kind of sad to me. I feel like there's a better way to market this that is more confident on Intel's part and on PC's part, rather than always aligning yourself against Apple. There's no cool factor, right? There's no cool factor like Apple had with its ads. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, Sherlyn.
I mean, I guess their so-called cool factor is, yeah, like you said, almost retaliatory. Like, here, we've got Justin Long now. He's a PC now. And he's all about these PCs and Intel chips. It feels very in line with my understanding of Intel so far, where they feel, I don't know if they feel attacked or they get a bit defensive every now and then, but they do interesting things. I'd much rather they focus on that. Like the architecture name is where they stack the components on top of each other.
They're 3D stacking tech.
Right.
That stuff is cool. And those chips, cool. We're still waiting to see more of that stuff coming. Like, we're waiting on the next generation of chips at the end of this year, I believe. So there's some cool stuff happening. It's just Intel is just facing it from all sides. Like, AMD is coming at it with killer laptop chips, killer desktop chips. Apple came out of nowhere with this chip that is faster than any x86 processor we've seen. So, yeah, I could see why Intel is doing this. I just feel like they need more confidence. They need to stop when Apple was doing these ads, right? They were the underdog. They were saying, like, look at big bad Intel and these boring PCs. We have cool new hardware. And they had that real ability to convey coolness. Whereas Intel's like, look over here, guys. Our PCs can do this. We can do that. And we have the Mac guy. There's nothing really there.
Yeah, right. Intel sounds like the whole more confidence in themselves thing. It just sounds like they need a bit of therapy.
Just believe in yourself, buddy. That's all. That's all you got to do. Yeah. Also, this week, I reviewed the AMD Radeon RX 6700 XT. This is AMD's new kind of mid-range GPU. It is a $479 graphics card that's kind of meant to compete with NVIDIA's RTX 3070 and the 3060 Ti. But, you know, I'm kind of mixed on this thing. I do think it's very fast at times, but the ray tracing performance is not great. The fans are very loud, and we don't know what the final pricing will be, because one thing we've noticed is that the GPU market over the past couple years is kind of a crap show. Like, it is, it's hard to get things in stock. It's hard to get things at the correct pricing. I was just looking at prices on Newegg. The RTX 3070, a card that's supposed to be selling for $499, if you can find it at all, it is going for upwards of $700. The RTX 3060 Ti, which is supposed to be $499, is selling for upwards of $600. This market is ridiculous and insane because scalpers come in and get this stuff immediately. And because of COVID-19, the supply chain shortage for chips and other things has also driven prices up. So it's a bad time to be buying a GPU. Hold out, folks, if you can, because I feel like this whole market needs to really step it up. One other thing I'll round out this little hardware corner with is some Alienware laptops. Alienware's new M15 and M17 laptops will have Cherry MX mechanical keyboards as an option. That's pretty cool. You'll have your nice clicky keyboards. Great for gamers. Gamers really like that for accuracy and for the way like multiple keys just kind of feel under your fingertips. So I wrote this up in Engadget. So yeah, go check that out. That's going to be a $150 upgrade. And they worked for 3.5 years with Cherry MX to design these keys. They basically created a ultra low profile switch design that kind of looks like the DeLorean doors that go up and down like Gullwing doors. It sounds cool. I haven't touched it or tested it, so I'm looking forward to seeing these machines. And I hope this sticks around because other companies like Razer have introduced semi-mechanical switches in laptops and then gave up on it almost immediately. So this seems like an inconsistent thing for this for this category.
And Cherry's like a really recognizable brand in the mechanical keyboard space too. Do we know, and I don't know if this is an appropriate question to ask for this product, but do we know what color switches they're using or?
I forget. I think it's more like the Cherry MX brown switches, but okay. I still like I cover PC stuff and even I like have a hard time keeping track of what's what here. But it is a switch that is the best. It is not very noisy, but it's kind of like the best average one. Yeah.
Yeah. Brown is definitely along the lines of like clicky, but like not so clicky. I like the red.
You don't
want to
be
sometimes
overdone. And they actually, Alienware posted some stuff on Twitter too, of like the idea of what this sounds like. Ooh. It could be cool. I don't personally rock mechanical keyboards because they are not really conducive to podcasting. So it is nice to have one around when I'm gaming, but most of the time I'm using like the Logitech Natural One that kind of arcs. I don't know if you have further thoughts on what mechanical keyboards could mean for laptops, Sherlyn.
I'd be curious to see the height or the thickness of the laptop given it has mechanical keys, but we'll see.
We'll see. Okay. And in other news, we're also covering South by Southwest this year. I don't know if you do you have any thoughts about what's going on? Because this is a weird show. We're actually all covering Engadget, but there's not much to cover at this point. Yeah.
It's like normally this show is already kind of a struggle to cover because for me on the team, I'm a bit more of a gadget person. So there's not a lot of gadget news at South by, but there's a lot of good tech demonstrations.
And culture stuff, culture news,
And culture stuff and entertainment stuff that would have, you know, where it overlaps with our scope of coverage. So usually it's like when I've gone, it's when I've gone and checked out a Sony experience or a beauty tech demonstration. Mm-hmm. This year, all we're doing is, I mean, different from you because I'm not helping out with the XR and VR stuff, but I'm just looking at panels. And
the panels aren't great.
The panels are just not newsworthy is the thing. Mm-hmm. They might be like it's forcing us to think about things, which is good, but not in a way that we can crank out coverage on. Because Engadget is more like about if we do a like a piece on what happened at South by, it's more like analyses and trends. And there's just not much that's new that's being said, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. How about your experience? You did the XR and VR stuff?
Yeah, I've done some. I did this thing called Finding Pandora, which won awards at the Venice Film Festival. And it was kind of cool. It was like a live theater thing where I joined the, I believe it's called the VR Chat app. And I basically took a role as one of the Greek chorus and followed along as Zeus and Hera tried to find Pandora's box after Pandora died.
That's cute.
It was kind of it's a cute performance. It was fine. It wasn't like groundbreaking or revolutionary or anything, but I will probably be writing something up about this and also other AR and VR stuff I'm seeing at the show because they basically recreated downtown Austin in VR form in VR chat. So you can go walk around and look at art stuff. So I know you have an Oculus Quest too, Sherlyn. So like you can log on, just go walk around. Yeah. That's a cool thing, but it is, you know, I think South by is one of my favorite shows because it is mm-hmm. such a perfect balance of everything I love, like movies mm-hmm. and pop culture and music and games yeah. and tech. Like, it's all of it at once. And a big part of the appeal is just walking around downtown Austin yeah. and meeting people and seeing people in person. So I think with a traditional film festival like Sundance, you know, we were able to replicate quite a bit like of actually seeing movies at home. And South by mm-hmm. has a lot of that, too. But not any major premieres or anything. And for me, the real vibe of South by is just that. It's the vibe of hanging out, maybe mm-hmm. seeing celebrities down the street or something as you're walking to a bar or a party. So this one really makes me miss real life. Yeah,
totally. Like the mm-hmm. random appearances too. Like I remember again, the one South by that I covered. Uh-huh. Yes, the vibe is great. The food is amazing. Mm-hmm. I wish when you said they recreated downtown Austin, I was like, oh my sort gosh, of. Do they have the food trucks? Yeah.
Yeah.
But I, you know, one thing I liked about the South by that I covered was that was a South by where Elon Musk just appeared out of nowhere and held a panel. Out of nowhere. And it's like, all right, cool. Like, that's what we're going to do. But that's not going to happen. It could totally much more easily happen.
He's going to spend his time in Clubhouse. Show. Like, he will randomly pop up in Clubhouse now and not go South by panel.
Yeah. And be like, squad, I'm on Clubhouse talking South by Southwest this time. Come on over. And then all the people who are not on Android can't get on. So there you go. Or we're not on Apple. I mean. But yeah, it's kind of a wash, unfortunately. But we'll see. But I found it good for networking. So far, I've been finding interesting people, mm-hmm. topics, and stuff like that. So it'll help my long-term reporting.
Cool. Well, any other stories you want to hit quickly, Sherlene? We had a bunch of news this week, and we're just like, I think we spent way too much time on Samsung and their dumb little event. But
so
there is
much.
Google stuff still?
Yes. Yeah, so Google antitrust, basically there was a suit filed against Google from the Texas Attorney General, I believe, a while ago. And it was in December, I believe, that it brought a suit about Google's anti-competitive conduct and what it believes were monopolistic advertising technology practices. So basically, you know, Google is very powerful in its ad sales mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. at networking because that search is everywhere. This week, the news is that the suit has been amended to include or target Google Chrome's privacy sandbox, which we, I think, talked about earlier in earlier episodes of the show, where mm-hmm. Google's basically trying to figure out a way to enable ad tracking without third-party cookies. And privacy sandbox is a set of proposals the company's considering to do that. So things like Flock, things like federated learning of cohorts.
Right.
Are part of privacy sandbox. So it's still worth knowing that like the suit's been amended to target new things, but it's done in a way that doesn't seem to understand the market. It feels to me, so the amendments in the lawsuit accuse Google of, quote, hiding its true intentions behind a pretext of privacy, and that the changes would put, quote, Google's Chrome browser at the center of tracking and targeting, which Google has since refuted and told Engadget. The actual wording is here. Attorney General Paxton's latest claims mischaracterize many aspects of our business, including the steps we are taking with the Privacy Sandbox initiative to protect people's privacy as they browse the web. So that's Google's statement. And I just feel like, for once, Google's not wrong. I don't think Privacy Sandbox really... Yeah. I don't know enough.
This seems like a good example of also legislators not quite understanding the tech and when the tech is trying to change. But this is going to be the last antitrust thing we see from Google or against Google for some time. Like, we're seeing stuff all around the world. And this is good because I do think even if these countries are misunderstanding what Google is doing, it will at least force Google to kind of try to explain itself more. So, I want countries to be more involved with this. I just hope they get more informed with how they do it. So moving on to what we're working on and what am I not working on at this point? This week has been kind of insane. I've just had multiple reviews go up. In addition to the Radeon RX 6700 XT, I also reviewed Dell's 40-inch ultra-wide, ultra-sharp 4D monitor. So go check that out on the site. I'm working on maybe a review of the Asus ROG G15, which is a slightly bigger version of the G14 that we really liked last year. Has some really great hardware in it, including an AMD CPU. So I have it right now. I just like the look and feel of it. So I'm looking forward to reviewing this. Eventually, I'll be writing something about the Justice League Snyder Cut that's debuting on HBO Max. I wish I had time this week to deal with it, but I just don't between South By and everything.
Did you see the tweets already going around about it?
I mean, I saw a lot of tweets.
Aspect
but
ratio.
What?
Yeah.
We knew the aspect ratio. We knew that was a problem because that was in the trailers. So it is the whole thing. We'll be talking more about this, but I am personally not looking forward to spending 4 hours watching this movie in a boxy aspect ratio. But yeah, report back, folks. Let us know what you think of the Snyder Cut Justice League. We'll be talking about it next week. Sherlyn, what's up with you?
Yeah, you know, people know the OnePlus event is March 23rd. I'll be prepping for that. And I'm still working on some research and interviews that I'm doing. I don't want to give it away just yet because I don't want to be scooped. So coming, just know that I'm doing some research on some interesting things that you'll see on the site, hopefully next week. The Nest Hub that we talked about today, I should be getting one soon to review. So, you know, I'll be sleeping a lot. And one piece of accessibility news that was unveiled sort of overnight. Chrome is getting live captions, which I think is a really cool tool.
Oh, cool.
That's something that should benefit a lot of people.
Is that going to work on all videos? Is that what's up?
At least what happened overnight is we saw a release to the Chrome channel that brings the feature. So we don't have a lot of official details just yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if we saw this more details about this soon. So I would say stay tuned to the news/engadget.com.
Cool.
There we go.
Let's move on to what we're watching and some pop culture picks for us. And I just want to shout out Ryan the Last Dragon, which is a movie I think you'll really enjoy, Sherlyn. This is Disney's...
I don't want to pay for it.
I mean, yeah, you don't want to pay for it. Wait a couple months. But right now, it is a $30 rental on Disney+. Mm-hmm. And this is Disney's first Southeast Asian set story, or at least a story influenced by all the cultures there. Raya is basically a Southeast Asian princess. And this movie, it's a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. It has a lot of influences from Avatar, The Last Airbender, and The Legend of Korra, and a lot of Miyazaki films like Nausicaa and The Valley of the Wind. It is an adventure story. It's an action movie. It's about a girl who is learning to trust other people once again, but it's also like very much a martial arts movie. Like there's some great fights, there's some great action sequences, and I really dug all that. But yeah, I'd actually really be interested to hear your take, Sherlyn. So whenever you get around to seeing it, we should talk about it again. I had a lot of fun with it. I do feel like it's a movie that could also go a little harder in certain respects. It is not like the most original thing from Disney. And something I've talked about with, you know, on the Slash Filmcast, my podcast at slashfilm.com, we talked with Hoi Chen Bui, who is Vietnamese, and she talked about how she felt like this doesn't really represent any specific Southeast Asian culture. It's kind of like a melange of everybody all at once.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a great thing either. But hey, it's something. And I think it's really enjoyable. My daughter, Sophia, really loved this movie. But she also loves movies about tough girls with swords, apparently. So, yeah. She is her father's daughter. Yeah.
Well, I'll let you know when I do watch it what I think. Because I already have a sense that, like, the guest that you had on your podcast was probably right. But we'll get to it. It might surprise you and cause you to shake your head to find out that I just watched WALL-E for the first time recently.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
I was pretty depressed at the start, but then it got good.
It's a pretty depressing movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
At least when it comes to humanity.
Yeah. But that's not my recommendation. This week I have I watched two relatively new movies on Netflix. And the one I'm going to recommend of the two is Boss Level. Have you seen it, Devendra?
I saw that's Hulu. But yeah, Boss Level
is that Hulu? Oh, my bad. Yeah. On Hulu and Netflix. The two movies I saw, were on Netflix and Hulu. But yeah, let's start with the Hulu one. Boss Level. Of the two I watched, let's just be frank now. I watched Boss Level and Block Island Sound. And Block Island Sound had the higher Rotten Tomatoes rating, but lower IMDb rating. Boss Level was just more consistently scored across the board, both IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes. I actually preferred Boss Level. Boss Level is basically
It's a big dumb action movie. Yeah, come on. It's fun.
Yeah, but Block Island Sound is really more in line with my taste, right? Because it's very science fiction and horror-y and suspense-y. But anyway, yeah, Boss Level is fun. It's Frank Grillo stars as this former military guy who gets caught up in a Groundhog Day scenario where he's
time
reliving
loop.
A day.
Yep,
a time loop over and over again and has to figure out how to break out of it. But it's a very gory and fun video gamey take on the genre. Very different from that Christian Milani. What's the title of that one again?
Palm Springs.
Very different.
Although it's funny. It's like it's almost a year after Palm Springs, Hulu debuts another time loop movie because...
Where we're stuck living the same day over and over.
Living the same thing over and over. But this movie is a lot of fun. I saw this too, actually, a couple weeks ago. And I want to shout it out for anybody who likes gaming stuff or time loop movies or just like fun action. I really like Joe Carnahan as a director. He has done some great, great action movies. He did the A-Team remake, which nobody really liked, but I thought there was a lot of good stuff in there. And he did The Gray, which also co-stars Frank Grillo and Liam Neeson. Mm. And that movie is Liam Neeson versus Wolves. And that movie is awesome. So be sure to check out The Gray. And if you want a taste of what Joe Carnahan can do, I suggest look up his BMW film, which is something they were doing in the early 2000s to kind of show off BMW cars, but also pair them up with good directors. He did that, stars Clive Owen as like this mysterious driver of cool BMW cars. And it's a cool chase, little action short film. So that's worth checking out too. Yeah.
Speaking of shows that I watched for the first time only recently and also action shows, I saw Girl with the Dragon Tattoo for the first time recently too. And
you mean the TV series or the movies?
The movie, the American version of the movie. I was reminded overnight that there is a Swedish version. The one starring Rooney Mara. Yeah. And it was hard to watch at times, but really, really good.
Yeah.
In terms of the mystery. Yeah. In terms of the mystery, there's parts of it that are hard to watch. But anyway, these are all things that you can watch if you want to relax from the depressing news of
I don't know if the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is the
I don't
one
know that. Maybe boss level.
Boss level's
and then
fun.
Maybe. What's
boss level has like a cute, it's like a nice emotional core too, which is also something Joe Carnahan does really well. Action, emotion, feeling. It's good. That's it for our show this week, folks. Thank you for joining us. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Trillin online at...
If you want to send me cartoon recommendations that I still have yet to watch, probably, I am at Sherlyn Lowe on Twitter.
I am at Devendra on Twitter, and I also do the / Filmcast podcast at /film.com. Email us at podcastandgadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. Be sure to stay tuned after the end of this episode because we're going to have some of our interviews coming up. I'll be chatting with Fede Alvarez, the director of Calls, and Sherlyn, you were chatting with Robert Kirkman, right?
Indeed, to talk about his new animated series, Invincible, on Amazon.
We'll start with Sherlyn's interview, and that's it for now, folks. Thank you very much.
Robert, could you describe for me the show in your own words and sort of explain the tone and the genre here?
Yeah, I mean, Invincible is very much a superhero show, but it's also a coming-of-age story for Mark Grayson, who is, you know, coming into adulthood and entering into this world of superheroics, following in the footsteps of his father, Omni-Man. And it's a very dramatic and emotional story as he realizes that this world he's looked up to and wanted to be a part of since he was a very young child is very much not what he expected it to be and is much more dangerous and much more dire than he could have ever hoped for. And, you know, now he's kind of knee deep in this world he wasn't prepared for and having to deal with that.
I mean, it's also not, I'm personally, when I look at adult animations, I mean, they're either really, really biting and hilarious and sarcastic sometimes, or they're heartwarming. And I feel like this is kind of a mix of the two where there's moments where I really liked where like you really get into the insight of what a superhero's powers are, for example. I think the learning to fly a bit and mastering all that, but also the just the life, how to be a family of superheroes ish. But what would you say is the emotion you're expecting a viewer to feel watching this series?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I mean, I hope it runs the whole gamut. I mean, we're trying to, you know, basically do what is an hour-long cable drama in animated superhero form. So I want you to be scared. I want you to be happy. I want you to be surprised. I want you to be horrified at times. You know, there's going to be some times when you're very sad about what's happening. And hopefully there's times where you're feeling sheer excitement. I mean, there's a joy to these superheroes sometimes that you know, is really great. And then other times they're, you know, suffering like an absolutely crushing blow and you don't really know if they're going to be able to make it. And so I hope that you can get invested in these characters the same as you would Walking Dead or any other cable drama and, you know, just kind of go along with for the ride and experience their world in a very real way as the series progresses.
Yeah, you mentioned that. I think that's, again, to me, this is somewhat unique, but maybe I'm mistaken. But just the fact that it's, like you said, a cable drama, but in animated form, what are the challenges around creating something like that?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of animation is, you know, contained in that half hour format. And so, you know, working with our storyboard artists and our animators and our overseas studios, we kind of had to acclimate them to this longer format and, you know, learn how to structure scenes a little bit differently and things like that. And, you know, that was a slight learning process. But I think that more than anything, to have the cast that we have and to be able to give them the room to live in their performance and inject a lot more drama into the stories that existed in comic book form when we were doing it as a comic, you know, to elevate the material and expand the material in the way that we're able to do with this much time is really great and is going to make for a really cool show.
You mentioned the cast, and I was curious, I guess this is a two-part question. One, was this produced during the pandemic? And two, you know, I'm sure they were given lines, but did they have flexibility to kind of change around? Because the animated works, right? You generally just expect the voice actors to just read what they're given and inject expression or emotion into it. But, you know, do they have the room kind of to come up with things on the fly or ad lib, or
yeah, is it a little stricter? Well, one, I'll say that, you know, this was produced, you know, before the pandemic, during the pandemic. Hopefully it'll be being produced after the pandemic, which is hopefully coming very soon. But all of our voice acting was done mostly in 2019, aside from some pickup lines and ADR that was done after the fact, which was done remotely. But you know, we were able to be in studio with the actors, and because, you know, it was done in 2019, it was done, you know, as the animation was starting to be done. So we had times to, you know, shape those lines and work with those actors on their roles the same as you do in live action. So, you know, I was very much in a booth, you know, having Mahershala Ali say, "I can't say the line this way. This doesn't work this way. Can I say it this way?" And I'd be like, "Absolutely. Like, that's, you know, you're a genius. Do whatever you want." You know, then you also have Jason Mantzoukas, who is an absolutely brilliant improv artist, and you know, same as Steven and Gillian Jacobs and a lot of our actors. But, you know, Jason is going to give you a different line reading every single time. And he's going to be adding lines. And a lot of those ad-lib lines got worked into the show and are some of our funniest moments. And so that's really good. But yeah, we were definitely able to work with all of the actors to not only, you know, do what was on the page, but to be able to add to it and expand on it however they saw fit.
And I guess the other question about a bit of the behind the scenes working with here, and as Engadget, obviously we're more curious about the tech versus the non-tech side of things. So, for example, you've obviously had a lot of experience working on The Walking Dead with AMC. What was the experience like working with Amazon this time around? Do you feel that was a bit maybe more freeing, or maybe there was different restrictions you didn't think about? How was that experience like?
I think there's less content restrictions on Amazon than there are in AMC, just because of how the two outlets operate. AMC is still it's still a cable channel that has paid advertisements. Amazon, you know, exists in a completely different space. So there's a lot of differences there. You know, as far as, you know, how Amazon worked on this show, I think that, you know, it was a very free experience. We were able to follow the story where we wanted to go, and whatever the story needed was A-okay by them. They were very supportive. This is a very dramatic show, but it is also a very violent show. And a lot of that drama comes from that violence. And I was, you know, worried at any moment that I would get tapped on the shoulder and they'd be like, "Hey, you know, tone it down a little." Luckily, you know, they never really did that. And if anything, we were always encouraged to push those envelopes, because I think if you see from, you know, what they're able to produce with The Boys and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and all the different great shows that are on their platform, they're a boundary pushing company that wants to bring something new to the form of television. And so it's great to be a part of that.
Do you think, and I don't know your experience with working with some of the other streamers like Netflix, for example, but do you think this is kind of a trend we're seeing, that online streamers are a little more free with the content maturity, maybe, or just the limits they're willing to explore? Is that a trend in the industry?
I think it's a case-by-case basis from streamer to streamer. I think everyone has their different content. I think Disney Plus is certainly looking for something that, you know, is a little bit more family-friendly than, say, you know, Netflix is able to do. But, I mean, Netflix runs the whole gamut between family-friendly and very mature content. So I think that, you know, there's certainly a sense of, you know, it's not necessarily the Wild West out there, but with all these different streaming services entering the market, you know, there is a sense of almost anything goes. I think that can be very freeing, but, I don't know. I mean, again, I haven't worked with all of them, but that just seems to be my general sense of the landscape.
And does that make you kind of feel like we all know who you are in the field, right? And it's really interesting to feel like, I mean, I'm a huge fan of The Walking Dead, so, yeah, but it's interesting to think about your perspective in this where, you know, for a lot of independent, you know, filmmakers or show producers out there, maybe they're like, oh, we're just hoping that with more people or studios approving or ordering these this pieces of content, for them it's just like more chances to get seen. But for someone like you who's a bit more of a vet in the field, I was curious about your perspective. Like when you're creating a new show, like say Invincible or whatever else you might have cooking, whether this makes you think differently. Are you targeting a specific streamer? Are you thinking, heck, I'll just make something, someone's going to pick it up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess. I think that, yeah, I still try to cater to whatever audience I'm going for, I think. You know, Invincible, I think, is, you know, a very specific show. I mean, there's only a, you know, I think there's a tremendously huge audience out there that loves superheroes, and mm-hmm. we're trying to, you know, definitely be on the mature side of things, which I think differentiates us from a lot of superhero shows. You know, we're doing different things with the format. I don't know. I mean, I think what excites me the most is doing things a little differently and pushing boundaries. The fact that this is a hour long animated show is a little different. The fact that it's a superhero show that is animated and mature, you know, sets it apart. And I think doing new things is exciting to me. And because of that, I think that, you know, what these streaming platforms are allowing us to do is really exciting as a creator, because you're not on a network where you're just trying to appeal to the most massive audience possible so that they can buy the most advertisements on that show. The name of the game now is there a segment of the population out there who is not currently subscribing to our streaming service who will for your show? And so they encourage you to be as niche as you want to be, because that might bring a new audience to their platform that will then watch all of their content. So it's a little bit freeing creatively.
So a little bit back to the show really quickly. I think we just like to hear, this is more like from your own words. Some of these characters are quite familiar. I think I see the Flash or Omni-Man is just kind of the everyman, you know, every big superhero. How do you see these sets of heroes differentiating from everyone else? Or is the familiarity kind of intentional?
Well, I think for the ones you're talking about, especially is the without spoiling things too much, it's possible that the characters that are the most familiar are the ones that die the fastest. And the reason that they are so familiar is because I want you to have a sense of who they are, and I want you to have some form of a relationship with them so that their demise has impact. If they were completely new, different characters, because they die so quickly, you wouldn't have that sense of, oh my gosh, I can't believe we just lost that character. And so it's kind of a shorthand. It's kind of a cheat, if you will. You know, there's a lot of originality into the core cast of our characters that I think will carry this series forward for many years to come. But, you know, superheroes, you need to have a certain familiarity with that world. And so there are some aspects where you can kind of see like, wait a minute, Cecil Stedman is kind of like a Nick Fury. Like he's kind of the guy that's going to be overseeing things. And that makes it a little bit more interesting when he starts behaving less and less like Nick Fury. You're like, wait a minute, I thought he would be this kind of guy that does this kind of thing. And he's not that at all. What's going on? It kind of builds intrigue into the story by lulling you into this sense of, you know, complacency where you're like, I know what's going to happen now. And then when we pull the rug out from under you, you're like, whoa, I didn't expect this from this show. And hopefully that keeps an audience engaged and it makes them keep coming back week to week for more.
I mean, that sounds a lot like The Walking Dead, except for very heart-wrenching in both ways. I mean, Steven Yeun as the main character, one of my favorites from Walking Dead as well. But as an Asian
I
person, I
do.
have to say this. He seems to be one of the few, Asian male superheroes occupying a lead role in the series that I've seen.
Yeah, I guess so.
I
I mean, short of Shang-Chi coming out next year, yeah.
I guess I was asking if it was deliberate, and if there was any in drawing him, were there any deliberations or thoughts around portraying him? I guess hammering that point home, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that the race of Mark in the comic book series was ambiguous. It was never stated one way or the other, you know, if he was Italian or, you know, Puerto Rican or whatever, you know, just because he wasn't clearly defined. When it came time to do the series, we thought it was a little bit more important to make sure that our series represented the world around us in a more realistic way. You know, the comic book series was set up you know, almost 20 years ago, when that kind of thing wasn't as in the forefront. I'm very proud of how diverse the comic book series was, and we did a lot of groundbreaking things and did a lot of things with representation. But being able to push that even more, being able to take the Amber character and make her black and you know, do different things to show that you know, this is more accurately reflecting the world around us was very important. Casting Steven Yeun in this role, you know, I cast him because I knew him and I knew he was great and I knew he would be a great job, that he would do a great job. I didn't cast him because, you know, he's Korean. But I think that that gave us a tremendous opportunity to, you know, show an audience, like, yeah, you know, like superheroes can be anyone, and you know, it's great to be able to do that.
I'm out of time, but love to keep talking if ever possible. Thank you so much for your time, Robert.
And now on to my chat with Fede Alvarez, the director of Calls on Apple TV Plus. Fede Alvarez, thank you so much for joining us in the Gadget Podcast. Can you tell us what was your motivation for adapting Calls? Because this is a really unique concept as a show. Certainly not like something we've seen on TV anytime recently. So I'm really wondering what was going on in your thought process there.
I mean, Apple approached me with this concept, this format, right? Of what if we do this kind of Twilight Zone-y kind of show that will be just based on phone calls. And apart from that, you can do whatever you want, but it was basically the whole concept. And they allowed me to create a new visual language, you know, a complete departure from the show that were showing me, and also to create all the stories, right? I think the only story that had something in common, I think, is the first episode because we did a bit of a pilot, but then the rest, I had the chance to just create all this concept. And you know, coming from film, where in film you come up with what this one idea, and then you have to run with it for 2 years, right? And those characters, that group of characters, and that's it. So this time for me, I was like, oh, this is gonna be great, like in one single year. To be able to create a bunch of characters and a lot of scenarios and a lot of stories for the show. So there was something very special about that that really drew me in. And also the fact there was no rules. There was no, you know, a lot of shows and movies, even if the studio doesn't say it, they're just trying to be similar to something else or trying to play in the ballpark of the audience that like that other show. So maybe this is like this meets that. This was nothing meets nothing. I mean, there was nothing. This was going to be a completely new thing, and that felt great, very refreshing for me.
Awesome.
Obviously, it does have the DNA of the classic drama radio shows and things like that, but on its own, because of the, it was a combination of that, obviously with new technology and graphics and something you have not experienced before. So, it was that was what drew me in. Just to the fact that it was no playbook or no Bible for it. It was just really free for all
Gotcha.
when it comes to create.
It's funny whenever I talk to people when they're trying to make something in a limited kind of way, they find a certain freedom in that. Is that basically what you found to be true?
Yeah, for sure. I think usually when it's shorter, I think because probably because of budgets and whatnot, there's always more freedom when it's a bit more experimental, right? So in this case, at the same time, it was great to do something so experimental in the context of something so mainstream as Apple, right? Which is what made me really excited, and I was so kind of proud of them in a way. I was like, great for that they just want to take roll the dice and something like this and let us create something. Where it wasn't until they saw the first episode that we'll have no idea what we're doing, right? Which was funny. Imagine Apple, that is all about 4K and colorful stuff, first episode start playing is a black background with a white line and nothing else in two names. It was like, what a second, what's going on? Obviously it evolves from that, but the yeah. idea, there was a lot of risk taken and a lot of experimentation. So it's truly, truly mm-hmm. special.
Do you see this as like exploring a new type of way of doing a TV show? Because yeah, it is sort of like, it is a radio drama, but the visuals I think are pretty important too. But maybe, I don't know if this is a thing where you intend everybody to sit down on their couch and just watch it, or like have it on in a way and experience it with headphones. I don't know. What is your ideal experience, your ideal way for people to experience the show? And what do you think this means for like the future of TV too?
Yeah, I don't know what it means for the future, but I do, I know that when it comes to my movies, I don't want them to experience them on the phone. I just want them
exactly.
theaters and eventually on the largest TV they can find. But when it comes to this show, honestly, it's one of those that I think you can watch it on whatever device you want, with headphones, without headphones, a big TV on the phone. Mm-hmm. I think you'll get a great kick out of it anyways. There's something special actually hearing on the phone, not even to headphones, like hearing on the phone to your ear, because kind of what I love about the concept, when you listen to the first episode, it kind of took me back to the days when I had a wireless, landline at home, and suddenly sometimes magically you could get your neighbors or someone around the block. You could mm-hmm. eavesdrop that conversation for a second. It was so wrong and forbidden, but you were hoping for some drama to unfold, which never did. In this case, it does. So there's something about that idea of on your phone hearing to some other people talking that is, it feels great, because it's like all the things that are great mm-hmm. in movies, they all kind of have to feel a little bit wrong. At least the things that I do in movies, they always have to be a little bit wrong. Like, this is really happening. I'm really listening to this conversation. So mm-hmm. there's something about that I felt that makes me think that it might be one of the shows that I'm okay if you watch it on your phone. I watch it on a television if it was me, right? And
gotcha. I was watching. I think I got through like half of the season so far, and I was watching it at night. It was very spooky. To just be listening to these conversations on a nice pair of headphones. Just wondering too, like, clearly you had to think a lot about audio production and the way you layered the audio and everything. Is this something like, did you think about it differently or in a more specific way than on your movies? And did working on the show kind of change the way you think about audio production moving forward?
Well, I think, look, when we started thinking about the show, there was no pandemic. Then when we started writing it, the pandemic slowly started. And then by the time we were going to go into production, there was a full lockdown. So we had to rethink the whole process. We were going to probably, the plan was originally to take the actors to stage and pretend to be talking on the phone. But then for me, it kind of felt great. I was like, look, I think it's going to make the show better in a way. It was the only silver lining on the pandemic, I guess. It was like, this is going to be people at home talking on the phone, actually talking on the phone to each other. And that's how we did it. We created what we call a football, which was just a suitcase with a laptop and a couple of mics. And we sent it to the actors. Actors that had no assistants had to figure out how to use it. Which is always fun to do. They did manage, for the most part of them, they did manage to work around the whole system. And then we connected wirelessly, through the internet with everybody else. But then when I was saying action, people were like, talking on the phone with everybody else in a way. And there was no pretending. What you get on the show is all these actors, they are at home and they are talking to each other. So it is Mark Duplass, it is at home. He's at home and he's talking with mm-hmm. Pedro Pascal, who is at home. So they are... there's very little pretending in it, which makes my work easier as a director. Usually when you give, when you create an environment around the actors that is very similar to what the characters will be experiencing. So I think it made for very realistic performances, right? But it was a lot of fun.
Can
it
you
was
talk more?
Fun that you could see, you could do it, that we could pull it off. That was very unique.
Can you talk more about that at home production too? Were some people, did they actually have phones up to their ears to try to mimic the, what they were doing? How do you direct somebody to do something like this remotely even?
Yeah, well, they do. I mean, we gave them some tips, obviously, about how to sound the way they're supposed to sound when they talk on the phone. Mm-hmm. So, the distance with the mic and all that. There's a lot of post-processing as well to make sure it sounds exactly like phone lines, and there's so many different filters and things, because depending on what kind of phone line you are, and if you're on a cell phone or a landline, it will sound completely different. So we really try to match that. Sometimes it's even radio communications in the show. So we had to really do a lot of work on that. But then a lot of it is on the actors. I mean, great actors want to go the extra mile. So I remember on episode one, you know, Nick Brown from Succession, you know, Cousin Greg, he's in that first episode, and he, when, you know, he had the first half of the episode, he's indoors, but then towards the end, he has to run outside, and he was like, hey, you know, it's going to sound better if I'm outside, literally. So he will take the mic and everything, and will just go out to the streets and run around asking for help with the mic, and, you know, all the neighbors getting really worried about his well-being. But he was really doing all the things. I mean, I remember Karen Gillan in her house pretending to be dying, and her dogs and the dogs and the neighbor's dog going insane because they were so worried about her. There was all this, the reality of doing all this at home was quite funny a lot of times. You know, they all learned to do it and figure out ways to sound the right way at home. It was, they all became like audio technicians on their own right at the end.
Did you guys capture any of that on video just to, like, I don't know, give us bit of, like, what it was like to produce?
I wish we had. I think we had some Zoom, you know, there's just the introductory Zoom call, because that's how we started every episode. We had Zoom, everybody was on the screen, and everybody would just explain the basics, to give direction, they'd talk character, and then when everybody was ready to go, I would just shut down the computer. I didn't want to see anyone's faces, so because they didn't want to get more than what you were going to get when you see it. So sometimes if you see an actor face, you get more emotion out of it, just of their expression. And then you think the performance is good enough. But when you hear the audio, the emotion is not there maybe. So I didn't want to see their faces. So I didn't get to see it. I wish I had seen some of those scenarios where, you know, with stuff like that was happening.
Oh, that's funny. So you even excluded yourself from that. Hilarious. One quick thing. I want to talk about the visuals too. Like, how did you go about bringing visuals to this, because this is mainly an audio story, but there was clearly a lot of cool stuff happening on the screen and things that, like, enhance the story too.
Yeah, no, definitely. You kind of need to see it to understand, to really get to fully understand most of the stories. There's a lot of clues also hidden in the graphics, right? I remember like this one that is has two sisters and one of, and the husband, one of the sisters, the ex-husband, seems to be an ex-husband, you're watching the whole episode, and by towards the end, when you start realizing there might be a little bit of a love triangle involved, you can go, oh, I've been watching a triangle since the beginning of the episode. So there's like a lot of clues hidden in the graphics that are important. Also a lot of text in between characters sometimes that you want to make sure you get. But you know, I think it's a very experimental way to translate the visual language of a film into abstract graphics. I think it can be done. Yeah. I think the show achieved that in many moments. Because I know as a director that if I want to make you feel a certain way, I will shoot an actor from a different angle, or just do an extreme close-up of an eye, or I would just put the camera very low to the ground and move very slowly down a hallway. And I know that creates a sense of dread if the light is in the right place. So the same here, there's the patterns of colors and movement. I know, you know, we basically translate them from film to this to create the same emotions in a kind of almost subliminal way. You might not even notice we're doing that, but you start feeling that, like, oh, it feels like someone's going to die. And it's just based on the color patterns that we're using that makes you feel that way. So there's a lot of kind of cutting edge experimentation of patterns and color and what it does to your brain. So it's not, it might seem random, but it's far from random. It's really, we try a lot of ways and we realize, but once we settle on a language and we knew what we were doing, like, it was a lot of fun to just, you know, do all the episodes knowing how we're going to create those emotions.
Excellent. Thank you so much for chatting with us today.
No, thank you, man.
Nice.